Okay, well, thank you for turning up at 9:30 after an enjoyable dinner last night. Particularly to hear something which is driven by a real sense of despair, but hopefully with an opportunity for clowning around in the middle of that. I confess I'm a philosopher, not a social scientist. Or I was. I first came for the philosophers, so I became a literary theorist. One of the things I'm interested about is that until Michael Gove manages to suck out all the joy from studying English literature, our department, I'm at Westminster in the middle of London, and for particular reasons there, is continuing to recruit students. It's been running a surplus since tuition fees have come in, although that's about to change as the value of those tuition fees starts to drop as interest rates rise. And therefore it's been expanding as a department. While simultaneously, of course, some of the STEM subjects have been losing numbers. So despite all our government's best efforts to social engineer our education, what I'm interested in the ways in which it often fails, and the ways in which something like academic development is something like a combined and uneven development. That's partly due to the peculiar backwardness of our academic institutions, but it means all sorts of contingencies and unexpected outcomes and contradictions emerge, which I talk about elsewhere, but I won't talk about too much today, except to say that there's something about teaching which still has a space in which something can happen. As I say, my department, 4/5 of its funding, of its budget, comes from tuition fees now, from income. Only 1/5 from research. And yet, at the moment, I realise for other people in different disciplines, it might be different. I realise some of these changes we're talking about are coming. But at the moment, that's largely unmeasured, ungoverned in any way. No one actually looks at what I do when I teach. So I think there's the small spaces of interesting opportunity that I kind of want to talk about. I agree with the consensus of what we're talking about. Neoliberalism, neoliberal capitalism is one of these forces that are governing academic life. But I want to start not by analysing the complexities of that, which other people are far more able to do, but suggest, as someone working in the humanities, that we also have to avoid falling back in traumatic times upon our existing habits of thought. And I come to offer you despair, not hope, but I think despair is far more politically mobilising than hope anyway. So, those conditions I talked about in my department are part of the dark times that we're living through. They depend upon charging students £9,000 a year. And this is part of a general trend I want to talk about to start with, of pedagogisation, which is work being done by, particularly in Belgium and Germany, by sociologists of education, defined by Mark de Papa as the orientation or trend towards thinking about education as a focal point for addressing larger human and social problems. So there's this idea, and de Papa looks at it in the context of colonialism abroad in the past. But I think after thinking about Henri Lefebvre and the way in which our capitalist masters have been using colonialist tactics back upon the transformation or colonisation of everyday life back at home, one of the things we can think about is the pedagogisation of life, all aspects of society. Today, I won't go into the details of this, but one context was after the riots in 2011 in England. If you look at the policy documents related to that, or the recommendations, because there wasn't an official inquiry, all of them have pedagogical solutions. All of them involve education as some kind of way of producing better, more obedient citizens, or somehow making people more fit for work or one of the problems is there isn't just too much under or unemployment and not enough jobs. But something about pedagogisation, more and more aspects of social life taking on an educational function. And I think there's three reasons for this, and I'm going to outline them and then suggest some responses to this. The first is all of these reasons are tied to what I see as a cynical rehumanising of capitalism as it becomes increasingly desperate, particularly after the most recent crisis. So there's three of these attempts to kind of cynically rehumanise capitalism. The first is the capitalist drive to seek new markets beyond those of traditional mass media, mass culture, where it has been quite successful in the past. So examples of the way in which Pearson's is now decoupling its publishing wing, which obviously is connected to Penguin Books, in order to push its educational technology. Second example is something like the way in which News Corp is now investing massively in its edutech division, headed up by Joel Klein, who some of you may know. And the reason is partly the decline of existing traditional media, but partly there's this existing national infrastructure which is ripe for capitalist asset stripping and appropriation. So this is why they want to get in here. There's an opportunity to make profits, hopefully in the future if they can get in early now. The second aspect of this kind of rehumanising, so that's a shift from culture to education. The second aspect is the rise of what Stephen Balls called the new philanthropy. This is connected to new forms of network governance, tied to all the kinds of ideas that Foucault was talking about in his later work on neoliberalism, but also ideas of control connected to what Deleuze is talking about. And this is this new philanthropy's attempt, is one aspect of this, the attempt to rehumanise capitalism through the re-emergence of corporate social responsibility, alternative investment industry, the attempt by hedge fund managers now to find high social returns on their philanthropy, levering intellectual, financial and political investment. And this, of course, is a Trojan horse for the first aspect I talked about, the attempt to break the unions and the attempt to get to make education more efficient and more rational. But it ties into a more general trend towards the fetishizing of education that I'm trying to express here. And the third aspect of this shift is the need to rehumanize labor for 21st century service and knowledge economies. Despite the idea that education might, public education as a project is dead, capitalism no longer needs workers of requiring certain skills because we can automate everything. And I think this is largely wrong, and actually under conditions of complete exploitation, there's no need to automate anymore. Actually, we can exploit workers who have all the kind of soft human skills that companies want now if they can be educated properly for these. And this is what we're seeing, corporations demanding from education more soft skills. So capitalism doesn't want zombies anymore. It does want proper humans. It wants to rehumanise labour so that the call centre worker is more efficiently able to go off script and sell you the products that they're trying to sell you. So, this is the idea of pedagogisation. That's my starting point in those three aspects. And it involves not just the expansion of education into all aspects of social and political life, but simultaneously a backwards move, the kind of ideas of corporatisation or financialisation of existing educations and the kind of pedagogy that goes on there. And this idea of pedagogisation is usually examined in the external context, to do with lifelong learning, adult retraining in terms of vocationality. But I'm interested in thinking about it as this is a phenomenon that reacts back upon existing pedagogical institutions. And this is usually experienced as something incredibly negative and destructive. So it leads to ideas about what Martha Nussbaum's called the crisis of the humanities, which is part she sees as a more general manifestation of a worldwide crisis in education. And what's interesting to me is how someone like Nussbaum's response to this crisis mimics the very rehumanising tendencies of contemporary capitalism I've looked at. So the title of a book, which is Not For Profit, works as a critique of commodification, but not as a critique of these aspects of philanthropy, the new philanthropy and these new aspects of networked governance. It doesn't work as a critique of not-for-profit corporations, which are coming in at the moment. And it's called to rehumanise capitalism by the inclusion of more liberal arts education is, of course, precisely what corporations are calling for as well in that aspect I talked about. And Nussbaum admits this. She says one of the reasons we need more liberal arts is not only to save education, because it will make capitalism run better. She says if there have been less yes men and more critical thinkers, a lot of the mistakes that capitalist societies have made over the last few decades would have been avoided. And I think something similar goes on with the rhetoric of the student consumer that's been constructed recently, which sees students as passive consumers of educational commodities. I think that tends to downplay the extent to which there's been passivity always complained about in education. I think it complains about, I think it misses or is in danger of misreading consumerism with massification. So as our educational space, particularly in higher education, become more diverse systems of mass education, there's a danger that we are confusing consumerism of our students with just a more interestingly diverse set of students, which we should be celebrating, and that demands new ways of thinking about teaching and learning. And the idea often constructed against the student as consumer is the student as co-producer or producer, which, for the reasons we've said, I think is in danger of equally being complicit with some of these trends towards pedagogisation that capitalism itself wants. That kind of rehumanising tendencies. But the last thing is it ignores those moments of agency that do go on in teaching spaces. It misses the way if students don't come up to lectures or don't have an essay. That's a moment of agency. It might not be one we like, but we shouldn't define that as passivity, I don't think. And we have to think about us being the last print generation and our students being the first digital generation as well, and all the kinds of changes that that requires. So, just to end, against this schema that I've laid out, I want to offer an alternative. I can do this as a more speculative philosopher. Lyotard talks about two kinds of humanism, and against that, two kinds of inhumanism. And we can connect this to early Marx's critique of the fundamental inhumanism of so much bourgeois humanism. As Marx, to paraphrase Marx, you know, there's not enough blood that bourgeois humanism can spread in order to get its ideals of a more humane society. And so against that, I want to think Marx's idea of a broader anthropological, broader materialist humanism that might require some kind of reaction against the humanism of existing society. That in other words, needs to be slightly more inhumane. And I draw on this from Benjamin and Brecht. I'm not going to go into them, don't worry. Benjamin and Brecht are thinking about how to survive under these desperately dark times in order to continue to be able to resist and fight. And one of the things that Benjamin does is against the bourgeois humanism that's part of the problem, but against any attempts of a Nietzschean type to therefore just move towards some kind of übermensch, the creation of some kind of overman. Benjamin constructs the idea of what he calls the unmensch, a flipped Nietzscheanism against humanism, which is the unmensch is the inhuman or the monstrous or the subhuman. And it demands that we draw our attention to or find consolidation with the most oppressed, the most despised, the most cast out of society. Not in some kind of sympathy, but partly in some kind of recognition or fear of them, because this is where the true overcoming of our current order lies. So to end on this idea of inhumanism against the prevailing rehumanising of capitalism, I want to make three points and then a kind of a conclusion. Firstly, I'm constructing, therefore, something, thinking against our habits of thought, that's got several characteristic features that have to be the flip of that humanism. The first is against the humanism of culture and education, which demands a philistinism on our part. We have to be more philistine. And that's coming from Malcolm Ball's work on the way in which aesthetics, particularly in left Marxist thought, hasn't been subject to its own dialectics. In other words, it continues to be seen as a privileged place in a very unhistorical moment of not thinking beyond it. I think we'll pass that moment, and we need to be equally philistine about our current educational institutions. That is not to fall into the trap, pedagogically, of thinking that education can save the world, or that we can save education without somehow transforming the world in the first place. So this is a recognition of the despair and darkness in which we live, which demands something more philistine. The second moment against that philanthropy, therefore, we need more misanthropy. We need a kind of hatred of humanity as it's currently formulated. And we need something like a social, affective, intellectual, critical strike. The demand not to do critical thinking, which can be used by, or not to do social forms of labour, or the general intellect that can be used against us by these new kinds of corporations emerging. and against the humanities, which is often the heart of the course, of the solutions about how we're going to save the university, I'm suggesting the idea of the inhumanities for my discipline. It's a block against, under traumatic times, falling back upon certain habits of thought. So this is my concluding point. I realise that's very speculative and I don't have much time to develop it, but I want to say why I'm doing this. My concluding point, I want to read you two quotes and then say what I get from these. This is a quote from Bell Hooks. And then I'm going to read a quote from Andrew Samuels. Bell Hooks, in Homegrown, Engaged Cultural Criticism from 2006, is in a conversation. These are two conversations. The dialogue form is quite interesting. She says, look at the living simple and living with less trends in the mainstream. And this is kind of slightly before the worst excesses of austerity. She says, the people in our nation who are forced to live daily with less are the poor, yet we disparage them instead of holding them in high esteem for their resourcefulness. The prevailing image of the poor in mass media is still of a criminal class, certainly not a teaching class. And my second quote is a conversation between the depth psychologist Andrew Samuels, talking about a book called Politics on the Couch. The interviewer says, the usual expectations that therapists will want to treat society as a sort of client has been completely turned on its head in your book. You want us to think in terms of citizens being the therapists. This is a profoundly empowering reversal. And Samuel says, it's one of the key things in my thinking, you're right. I've turned the traditional formulation around. The traditional formulation is that the citizen is a baby and society is the mother or father or parent. I thought that citizens have a potential to be therapists to the society that spawned them. And these were inspirational ideas for me about how to reverse the assumptions that we make as educators, that it's us that will educate society to become better. And actually, thinking about the student as public, one of the advantages of what's happening in mass education, despite the attempts to commodify it, is this expansion is turning universities into, despite all their problems, certainly the most diverse social spaces they've been. Of course, that's completely lacking in diversity in attempts to the rest of society. But this is not the time to abandon the university either. But this mass expansion of universities is bringing the public in. And I think we need to think about the reversal that happens there. So I'm thinking about a concept of teaching, which is the mutual transformation, not so much of the student, but the way in which the student comes to transform the educator and the educational environment. That's the kind of way of thinking that I think is more useful than falling back into the current traps. And so that's my concluding point, that I think there's something interesting that's happened despite all the intentions of our government at the moment, which is that learning spaces, if we think about them in terms of the inhumanities, open up the possibility of something becoming more inhumane in the sense of against that usual bourgeois humanism. And that's leading to the transformation of universities themselves in ways that I think are quite interesting. I'll end there. I know there's all sorts of things that I could say further about that, but I'll conclude.
Yeah, I'll do this one.
I'll just shout. I'll keep standing up. Okay.
All right, so myself, Carl, Sam, and Mike, we're all teaching business schools, which would be these sort of architectural masterpieces, which look like this. And people, you know, this is where almost more soon. It might be more, about half of all UK students going in to do their education in business schools. So one of the kind of critical ideas of what business school is doing is that you would have young, innocent, cute people coming in, and then they sort of pack together. This is one from one of the first year lectures, and then we skin them, kill them, and you would repackage them in a way that they could be sold and be more appetizing in a market. And this is what people would call the McDonaldization of the university. All right. That's one kind of critical image of the business school and what the business school produces. There's been another sort of critical image of what a business school is doing, and that is that it is producing morally defunct people. There's been a little bit of research on this. I'm not sure how reliable this is, but they did a study at Cornell, and they were sort of looking into the progression of students over one term. And they took three classes and compare them. So the astronomy was the control group, and they had the two forms of introduction to microeconomics. And one professor was a game theorist, the other professor was a development economics. It turned out after only one semester that they were giving these different sort of moral scenarios. If you find a $100 note and an envelope with a name on it, would you send it back to its owner? And the people who'd been studying economics for one semester showed a very sort of clear degree of a decreasing ethical inclinations, and so did the ones studying economics development, whereas astronomy you could find no notable difference. So this is another sort of idea what a business school would do, that basically would produce different forms of gangsters. And I found here's just an alumni pictures. So this is Franklin Girardo. And he was, in 1996, he was guilty to laundering $36 million on behalf of Colombian drug lord José Santa Cruz. And he's also one of the people sort of pioneering money laundering. You've got Rajaratnam, who was sentenced to 11 years for orchestrating different forms of insider schemes. And finally, you have Rajat Gupta, who serving 2 years in prison for leaking corporate secrets about Goldman Sachs, where he was based, to another hedge fund. And this was at the very height of the financial crisis. And you do have business professors in business schools who would say that this is by no means some incidence, and that the business school actually is not just complicit, but actually producing these amoral and sort of gangster culture, if you like. So they are the result of an amoral culture that we business school professors help foster. And so in this sense, you know, the business school seems to be the perfect place to go from being, you know, having critical inclinations to becoming a sort of fully fledged professional gangster. So something like this.
Okay.
So you may recognise this from The Wire and Stringer Bell, sort of moving his way up the food chain and becoming more and more of a sort of professional gangster. And he would learn a lot from his business school studies, take the messages to heart, start reading Adam Smith. So going from being a sort of street gangster to becoming the more sort of legitimate counterpart. And in that way becoming more of the establishment. Now, this is something that business school people would regard as a problem. And a lot of, especially American business school, have acknowledged this as a problem. And the solution they have offered to create more ethically sensitive, enlightened people is, again, the humanities. And at London Business School, for example, they do courses in philosophy now. And there's also the other thing that with employability, which is the sort of main reason some people would argue that people want to get into a business school, that in fact you are going to be more desirable on the market if you have these soft skills, if you do philosophy, if you come from the humanities. And there's also a book that came out a few years ago which is trying to rethink the undergraduate business education by integrating more and more elements of the humanities, philosophy, literature, and other forms of cultural studies. So this is also, again, the claim, and Matt mentioned this, that you get in someone like Martha Nussbaum, that the humanities in some ways develops this kind of your civic competences, and you do become a better human being who could defend the ideals and values of a democratic society. But nothing of this is new, and the relationship between business schools and humanities go back a long time. In fact, it goes back to the very first generation of business schools. In his History of the Business School, Khurana, what's his first name? Rakesh Khurana talks about the first generation of business schools emerging at a time where you had a new kind of class of managers. This is, if you like, you know, the sort of emergence of the corporate capitalism. You have more and more managers. And the big sort of problem, or the kind of challenge here, was how could you persuade society and the public that a manager would be the most suitable person to run a business when what they were doing during the days could be something like the following. So what they had to do to win this legitimacy was to persuade people around them, society, that the manager was not just interested in looking after the business. They had a broader perspective, taking the whole society into account as some kind of philanthropist who, through the accumulation of capital, could distribute this wealth in a responsible manner and also in a sort of long-term fashion. And here the business school would present itself as the place where managers would be trained in the art of management. And a big part of that was to develop these skills of becoming a well-read, cultivated, well-spoken man. Someone with a kind of Humphrey Bogart look, or if you like, the Stringer Bell kind of a dapper style would work well. So the business school here is sort of closely tied to bringing the humanities into education as a way of legitimizing that particular role, with someone being disproportionately more paid than others. And indeed, today, this is what a lot of people would see as a welcome thing, because what we need would be more responsible managers who could look not just on shareholder value, but stakeholder value, incorporating corporate social responsibility, and all the rest of it. But I would say that there are two problems with this idea in relationship to the actual existing business school today. And The first one could be sort of illustrated through Frederick Winslet Taylor. So in his sort of famous studies that would become the start of scientific management, he didn't really do much else than asking some people to work really hard for a short period of time. Some really strong Hungarians who were executing a huge amount of work in a short period of time. And then he was using what they'd been able to do in that time and said, if you work this hard all day, you know, there would be amazing increases in efficiency. In some ways, that is what it boils down to. But really, the ideological message here, I think, is captured in this quote by Taylor, which says, the science of handling pig iron is so great and amount to so much that it is impossible for the man who is best suited to this type of work to understand the principle of this science, or even to work in accordance with these principles without the aid of a man better educated than he is. So in this way, the humanities in the business school would be a way of legitimizing this naturalizing this kind of class separation where the educated man could sit and doing his puzzle while sort of observing the people working and asking them to work a little bit harder. So for him, there would be... Yeah. So that would be the first problem. The second problem here, just to summarize, the problem here is that the humanities introduced into the business school is not necessarily the solution to corruption. In other, you know, in some ways, it would even just sort of intensify and further legitimize much of the role that the business school has had since its inauguration. The second problem with this image is to do with the actual existing business school. And here I've drawn someone like Stefano Harney. And if about 40% of all of the students in the UK are enrolled in business-associated, business-related programs, then you can have a society consisting of 40% managers. At least no one would like to live in that society. And what happens here, Stefano Harney says, in a business school where there is this massification of teaching, which again we are all sort of in favour of, is that these people, as he would say, would not be on the sort of capitalist side in the capital labour equation. They are rather on the side of labour. And this, we think, is an opportunity for teaching. And if we don't want to think of students coming into business schools as people that should be trained into becoming better leaders or to be trained into becoming more sort of well-spoken people, then what do we want them to be? And here, the kind of word that we've been playing around with a little bit is to think of a student as a public. And in some ways, we are sort of thinking of Paulo Freire here and sort of two images of education, that as long as you think of the student as some kind of consumer or some kind of student that has to go through education and to be integrated into the dominant system, there is a kind of instrumental form of education that aims to facilitate the integration of those students into those kind of prevailing norms and sort of class system that we live in. Against this, he would pose a kind of education that would be based on an awareness of their own sort of concrete social political reality, and by bringing that sort of awareness, bringing about some kind of transformation of their world. And we think there's a lot to be said about this idea of the student as a public, although there would be two limitations to this idea. we think. One is the a more sort of pedagogical one, thinking about students as public would still be to maintain, and this goes back to what Matt was talking about, that separation between those who will be educated and that person, the elevated intellectual, who would sort of spread the important messages and say what that mass of people need to learn to bring awareness of themselves. That's the first limitation in some ways. The other limitation is a more political one, which raises the issue of resistance and to what extent a public can be educated into some kind of form of resistance. So these are two. So while we sort of largely subscribe to the idea of student as public, we think these would be a pedagogical limitation and in some ways a political limitation. I'll just end here with kind of a provocative, I guess, a counterpoint. So instead of thinking of the student as public, one way of sort of at least addressing those issues, the political and pedagogical issue, is to think instead of the student, again, not as the gangster, as Stringer Bell, but think of the student as a bandit.
You are a parasite. That briefcase. So we're getting over it.
So this would be, and I'm drawing here on Eric Hobsbawm's 1969 work of Bandits, where, and I think sort of Stringer Bell is a good illustration of the gangster, someone who's educating himself and bringing that sort of that elevating himself in a way to be integrated into the system. And of course he ends up being cheated by Clay Davis, who's just higher up the food chain. But the bandit, and this is the bandit in Hobsbawm's words, does not yield to force or social superiority as the gangster would do, but remains loyal to the path of resistance. Also, Hobsbawm goes on to talk about the bandit as an outsider and a rebel, a poor man who refuses to accept the normal roles of poverty and establishes his freedom by means of the only resources within reach. And then, so the idea here of becoming a bandit is not to elevate oneself above the unthinking masses, the socially deprived or the poor. Instead, and this again goes back to some of what Matt said, his relation, and this is Hobsbawm's words, with the peasants is that of total solidarity and identity. So that would be the other sort of issue of bridging that kind of divide between the educated and those in need of education. Again, I'm working here with the bandit mostly metaphorically. So to end, and on a slightly provocative note perhaps, we could say that the new business schools would be not an elite institution as it used to be, producing gangsters, but instead the mass production of bandits. In this way, the business school should not engage the humanities to legitimize the operation of the gangster and its maintenance of prevailing power structures. Rather, it engages what we may call the inhumanities to give force to the bandit and fuel its struggle to undermine, unsettle, and ultimately delegitimize those same structures. So that is kind of the despairing hope, and that is how I will end.
Thanks, Vikal, for organising this this session, and to Anne and Mary for organising the conference, inviting us. Big round of applause to you. My name's Mike Marinetto. I'm going to be... How do we do this? Okay, I'm doing stuff. I'm going to do a presentation which focuses mainly on teaching the ungovernable, the governable, whatever, and again focusing on this idea of student as public, but looking at social science fiction. Now, I thought I'd start with this. I mean, this is essentially a conference about Foucault, and I thought I would start off by resurrecting Foucault via the miracle of modern digital technology. Just to see, because we've talked about a lot about his ideas, but it'll be interesting to see what Foucault's like in action. And here he is, funnily enough, in a quite famous Dutch interview with Chomsky, talking about the modern university.
Il s'exerce encore, il s'exerce en outre, de plus, par l'intermédiaire d'un certain nombre d'institutions qui ont l'air comme ça, de n'avoir rien de commun avec le pouvoir politique, d'une façon générale, tout le système scolaire, qui en apparence est fait simplement pour distribuer le savoir, on sait que cet appareil scolaire est fait pour
okay, here he is, as I said, talking about this university as this, what's seen as a benign institution, actually reproducing power and control and what have you. And that's sort of quite central to what I want to say this morning. At the same time as remembering Foucault, I sort of want us to forget him, which might be a bit of a contradiction, since this is a whole conference about Foucault. But what I want us to forget is, in some ways, his ideas, his theories, even his literature. In some ways, because what you have sometimes is this sort of very close reading of Foucault, which is part of this sort of specialist academic enterprise. What would be worth doing is actually remembering Foucault, the form of Foucault, the outsider French academic who was despised by the French academic establishment, to remember a philosopher who championed really unfashionable philosophies at a time when, you know, certain philosophical schools were really forgotten. Also to remember a philosopher who experimented with different forms of writing, and also to remember a committed intellectual taking up really unfashionable courses. And let's not forget the haircut that launched 1,000 haircuts. Even celebrities look like him today. If you need, this is the MasterChef presenter. I want us to remember, in some ways, forget Foucault the content, but remember the form. And that's central to what I want to say today about teaching. Because the idea of form and content, I think, is central to pedagogy and to the way we teach in universities. And the reason I sort of want to focus on that is that a lot of academic life, a lot of the way we teach, is very much content-led. It is content-obsessed. And Carl sort of he alluded this to what he said about the humanities, that in business schools, and we're talking about business schools, mainly not because we work in business schools, but because what happens in business schools today essentially is shaping the future of the social sciences more generally. You know, you want to look at the formalization of journal rankings, it happened and pioneered in business schools. If you want to look at the Americanization of social science, you look at business schools where it happened first. You want to look at the privatization of not happened in business schools. You want to look at the rise of the Uber academic consultant, happened in business schools. And social science departments have sort of followed it. So it's important to focus on business schools, because you may not work in one, good for you. I'm really pleased. But if you want to look at your future, have a look at what's happening in business schools. Listen to what Carl said, listen to what Sam and myself. Luckily, Matt doesn't work in a business school. He's He's a pariah. We hate him.
No, we don't. We love him, really. Sorry, that's a bit of diversion.
Basically, in business schools, the type of research and teaching, you have two types. You have the technical teaching and research, which is about sort of telling students, this is how derivatives work. Okay, derivatives are used to launder money for the Sinaloa cartel, but we won't tell you that, but that's how it works. And then you have the more critical management studies, which takes a dim view of managerial capitalism, of organisations and how they're run, and etc., of markets and what have you. And in the past, that critical management studies, which, by the way, really drives research in business schools. The research engine in most business schools is driven by the critical management theories. In the past, critical management theory drew upon Marx, say, or critical theory. Increasingly, certainly in the last 10-15 years, it's drawn upon Foucault. And what you're having, the strange thing is, a Foucauldian analysis is sort of being used in postgraduate and undergraduate curriculum. You have students exposed to stuff like this. And esteemed articles like this, and the idea is that if we expose students to this critical analysis, then we're going to create critical subjects. And it's sort of a hypodermic syringe type model of pedagogy, that you expose students to a particular type of content and you get a particular effect. It's really strange. We're going to have a generation of managers working for Sainsbury's or accountants working for JP Morgan that are sort of conversant with Foucauldian archaeology. We live in strange days. But I think that's a really flawed model of pedagogy and of teaching. I think it's a very crude model, and the reason I say that is partly due to my own experience, but also through reading progressive pedagogical theory, in particular the work of Henri Giroux, who's influenced by Paulo Freire, but I think he's taken Paulo Freire in sort of interesting directions. And Giroux's written about he's written about higher education and teaching in schools, in particular. But more recently, he's looked at childhood and the impact of corporations and businesses on childhood. But back in 1981, Freire wrote this in an essay, or I think a book, that radical pedagogy is not only about providing the correct critical analysis for students. In other words, it's not just about content. It also depends upon developing a sort of compatible educational process or style. Okay. I think what he's saying here is that progressive pedagogy should also pay attention to the form, and that in some ways form should lead content, not that content is unimportant. But I think what's perplexed me and perplexed Cam and Sam and in our teaching is how do you put this together in practice? How do you actually practice this in front of students? How do you redefine the relationship between content and form in teaching? And I suppose a clue or an important pointer is the debate about social science fiction, which has had a major influence in terms of our thinking about teaching, both in theoretical terms, but also practically. Now, the term social science fiction originated with... does anybody know who this is? Yes, I said, has a mafia. And he coined the term social science fiction in an essay written for a collection of essays about the emergence of a new form of science fiction during the 40s and 50s. This was published in the 50s, I think, 1950s. And he coined, Asimov coined this term social science fiction to denote a new form of science fiction that was emerging this time, which was less about space opera, more about exploring the human condition. And books such as The Female Man by Joanna Russ or Margaret Atwood are classic examples of this. But increasingly, bring this debate up to date, that academics, particularly social scientists, sociologists, have drawn on this idea of social science fiction to look at or consider a sort of alternative canon or alternative sources of social science outside of professional academia. And one of the, I suppose, leading articles, one of the most important articles in this respect was a piece written by Osborne et al., published in 2008. And they argue that professional academics are basically not the only people who investigate the worldly phenomenon from a social point of view. They're not the only ones that monopolise a social perspective on things. Weird sound emerging from that. Anyway, and the same point is made by Howard Becker in his book Telling About Society, where he explores different forms of social science or sociology. Actually, it's a brilliant book. I love that book. It doesn't get as much recognition as it should. But Becker and Osborne et al., when referring to social science fiction, mainly thinking about the sort of published outputs in respect of research. But what about the influence of social science fiction in teaching and pedagogy? And this is where I've sort of thought about the employment of an alternative canon in teaching and pedagogy, which sort of not only influences the content but also how teaching is delivered. And the alternative canon will include journalists such as Barbara Ehrenreich, artists, documentary filmmakers, novelists such as Thomas Pynchon, Gravity's Rainbow, and obviously dramatists. Key example being The Wire, which has been seen as a classic example of social science fiction. But how does the employment of social science fiction, how does that sort of, in teaching and possibly research, how does that work in practice? I suppose an interesting example is Slavoj Žižek. I don't know if I can refer to Žižek in a conference on Foucault, but I will anyway. He, otherwise known as the analyst of cultural theory, which a label which I really hate, but I'll use it anyway. And here's Žižek.
Part of his success, actually, you should try and explain something complicated with something more complicated, which is why I was here. But part of his Žižek's success is as, in a way, a kind of popularizer of Lacan, and his very astute and creative ability to condense a lot of Lacan's difficult ideas into very simple little analogies, often using film, for example.
And here's an example.
This is your last chance. After this is over, you take the blue pill, the story ends, you wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to do. You take the red pill, you say in one of them, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
But the choice between the blue and the red pill is not really a choice between illusion and reality. I want a third pill. So what is the third pill? Definitely not some kind of transcendental pill which enables a very fast food religious experience, but a pill that would enable me to perceive not the reality behind the illusion, but the reality in illusion itself.
I haven't got a clue what he was on about there, but anyway. but the reason why Gigé draws it, he does draw heavily. You've got this Hegelian weird mix of Hegel and Lacan and going on, but he does draw upon sort of popular cultural tropes, which I find that's an interesting part of anything from Kung Fu Panda to the Marx Brothers. But there's an interesting sort of idea behind this. And it came out in an essay that he wrote some time ago. Why do I resort so often to examples from popular culture? The simple answer is in order to avoid a kind of jargon and to achieve the greatest possible clarity. So I guess he has this in mind. He wants
to focus on lawful execution.
Avoiding a jargon is one useful byproduct of embracing the popular, if you like, embracing a sort of alternative canon. There's another byproduct, I guess, and that came through in a book by Gerald Gruff, a literary professor in the States called Clueless in Academia, which is all about the higher education system in the States and teaching. And he argues that drawing on a popular vernacular sort of reduces the distance between sort of the elite professional academic and those being educated as students. And this quote is taken from Gruff's book. And it's this idea of reducing that sort of distance that accumulates through the use of academic concepts and jargon and what have you, and creates, I suppose, it allows us to sort of siphon off the students that get it, the elite from the rest. But in my opinion, it's deeply problematic. But I also think this sort of drawing upon an alternative canon, drawing upon social science fiction, and employing this sort of these sort of techniques and in teaching has an effect on research, because one of the things that has come across in terms of research into the content of social science journals, and one piece of research is by Patricia Wilner, which was done in the mid 80s, and it's quoted in this book by Paul Haney, The Americanization of Social Science. And Wilner argues that basically she did a content analysis of the key social science journals in the States, and she's during the between the 1930s and 1980s. She argues there's been this drift of social science away from key public concerns during that period. And I guess since the 1980s, that's taken on, gathered a pace, really, with the increasing specialisation and professionalization. I'm nearly finished. And this, I think, what this the sort of exposure to social science fiction in terms of my own sort of research has sort of drawn me closer to the idea. I'm using this as an example because Carl alluded to at the end of his talk about the bandits and use of criminality. Because we work in business schools, essentially, what popular social science fiction has done, and it's done this better than I think academic social science, is drawn our attention to the way that illicit markets are increasingly interdependent. And that's come through through dramas such as Breaking Bad.
Seriously, when it's tough, you want a criminal lawyer, right? You want a criminal lawyer.
And the whole idea of Breaking Bad is this interdependency between mainstream, not only markets, but also mainstream professions and criminality. And essentially, when I'm doing business research, essentially what we're doing is essentially a new form of criminology.
It's not really an economic story or a finance story. It's organized crime. There's no difference at all.
Yeah, I mean, the language that people use, the bankers, it sounds so highfalutin to the
Okay, that's the Kaiser. But I suppose you could, if you had to give this, what I'm trying to do here, in terms of teaching, in terms of messing with form and content and bringing in fiction as well as non-fiction and sort of eschewing in some ways professional academic content and what have you. I suppose it has some affinity with what C. Wright Mills called a wobbly social science. Or you could call it low modernism rather than postmodernism. Or you could call it what Truman Capote called fact fiction faction. This sort of drawing upon, this liberal drawing upon different forms of fictional and factual narratives. Or what the Italian Ming Wang, this is quite a strange collective, called unidentified narrative objects. Or what a brilliant colleague of mine called Pedaganda, or remixing the curriculum. Or my preference is that sort of narrative social science that in some ways we don't do too much. I don't do too much critiquing, but what I'm doing is exploring various narratives using fact and fiction. And I guess, just to finish, I think Foucault would, even though I've completely ignored him for much of this talk, would readily agree with what I've done this morning, because certainly if a recently dug up interview is anything to go by.
Je ne dis pas les choses parce que je les pense, je dis les choses qu'on ne peut plus les penser.
I've completely disagree, and what I've just said, I do not think. Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. So, Mike presented a sort of something resembling a kind of solution or an alternative, and I suppose I'll present a problem, or the problem in a sense. And this kind of thing, I suppose it's my attempt to work out the conditions of my own work and reflect on it, and also to reflect on the conditions of academic production, or to develop a sociological understanding of our own conditions of production as academics. And this is a task Borjo points us to in Homo Academicus. So it's my attempt to sort of think about the present in relation to that. And a connected point was, I heard this story I was told at Manchester the other day, that secondhand, that people say that Margaret Thatcher introduced the research exercise framework and research assessment in the 1980s in order to make academics more like her father, who was a grocer and alderman and very hard working. But the effect of the research assessment framework has actually been to make academics a lot more like her son. So my attempt is to try and think through how this focus on journal rankings has created these kind of perverse incentives and quite damaging behaviours, and using Borjo to do that. So we have this proliferation of different journal rankings and citation lists, which you can find there. But one of the things that's interesting to me, speaking purely anecdotally, is that if you try and explain this to a member of the public, or even to your own father, academically, that this is how your work is assessed, your conditions of your probation, your promotion is determined by your publications in certain 3 or 4 star ranked journals, and it's only these publications that count, their response would probably be something like this. Because it doesn't really make sense to broader publics or to wider society. It just seems bizarre. I mean, most members of the public, if you speak to them, and this is anecdotal evidence really, they would think that actually what's important or what should determine our promotion is something like our teaching or writing important books. But it isn't what happened. And I think it is important to think about how ridiculous the conditions of our own job sound to other people. And in addition to that, if you look at, say, a journal like, I was looking at some of the 4 ranked journals but I didn't have anything else to do. So this is like, to get to professorial rank in a business school, you should be publishing in places like Transportation Research, Part D Methodology. This is the title of a four-rank journal. And if you actually ask an individual to read one of these journals from cover to cover, from the start to the end, if you ask a member of public to do that, and even if you ask most academics, they probably do something like this. Oh, okay! So I wanted to then go back to Bordeaux to try and understand some of these developments and what's happened, and to think about the journal rankings and their importance in relation to that. There's a nice quote here, I think, where he says, setting limits to cultural needs and aspirations at the same time as encouraging ignorance of those limits, restricting people's vision of the world and canvassing their support for this mutilated vision, which leads people to perceive as universal an extremely singular culture. And I think that's a very apposite description, actually, of what the effect of journal ranking lists are doing on academic inquiry. That we're perceiving as universal, as an objective arbiter, a highly contentious culture that, or set of publications that's only relevant to a very small number of other academics. Now, this is Bourdieu's attempt to sort of plot different academics and their perspectives. So he's looking at French intellectual culture in the 19th, French university culture in the 1970s. And he's got a sort of, in this plotting of different academics, and obviously French intellectual culture in the 1970s is an extraordinarily vibrant time. But what he has there on the far side is he has basically academic capital. So your level of prestige within the university, which is measured by things like your membership of committees, the number of PhD students, and arguably today something like guest editorship of journals would be a mark of academic capital. And on the other hand, he's got symbolic or cultural capital, which is wider intellectual recognition, wider, in some sense, high-end journalism, I suppose, you know, French equivalents of things like the London Review of Books. So you've got wider social recognition, which is what he understands as symbolic or cultural capital. But interestingly, if we look at these people with lowest academic capital, the top to the bottom is also seniority of teaching position. And if you look at people without senior positions in the university, if we look into that corner, which is the bottom left-hand corner, what we see is that these people that have lowest academic capital are all of the great figures of social sciences. These are basically the people that have defined social thought in the social sciences and humanities in the remainder of the 20th century and going into the 21st. But in the 1970s in France, there were actually people that had comparatively little academic capital. In the 70s, people like Foucault didn't necessarily have fully tenured positions. And you've got Roland Barthes there, Foucault, Althusser, Derrida, and Bourdieu. So there's an interesting point here, which is that academic capital or university prestige or position has always, in some ways, worked against wider academic capital. So this is something that's become more pronounced today, but it was the case even in the 1970s. So that's an important thing to think about, that, you know, if we think that the university is a space for ideas and debate, in some ways, Bourdieu is sort of suggesting that actually, you know, the systems of the institutional administration of the university aren't really working in favour of, if you like, the generation of broader intellectual culture and symbolic capital. So I wanted to say, well, what's happening now, okay? And I want to say that what happens with journal ranking requirements is that we have again this starving of symbolic capital or wider intellectual value through the extreme coercive imposition of a new form of academic capital, which is effectively journal ranking lists. And the key point, I think, which is very strong, is that this is now coercive, and it's important to keep this in the context of being of it being coercive, in that people no longer feel like they have a choice. And while we're thinking about why the pub book, and you know, it's the conditions of your probation or even having your contract changed in many universities is determined by the number of certain publications you have in certain journals. So the key feature is to be aware that junior academics don't necessarily, in many cases, don't actually have a choice. And it is important to be aware of how those forces are working too. And we have a system called the ABS list, the Association of Business Schools list. And we're told, basically, that you have to get 4 threes and 4s in these journal ranking lists every 5 years. And in effect, the idea is that if we don't achieve that as academics, you're made to feel in this pervasive atmosphere of insecurity that this kind of thing will happen. So basically, it is coercive in that sense. And it also leads to an extraordinary level of overproduction. So people no longer seem to, if people are being told at pretty much every university in the top 80, well, you need to be publishing 4 threes and 4s, we've got this colossal overproduction in which people no longer engage with each other in terms of ideas, but the number of metrics. So points seem to serve as a shorthand for people, which is an example of how dominant this academic capital is becoming. I mean, it's interesting. I'm talking from the perspective of business schools. I don't know how much this has analogies with people in humanities and other disciplines. But this is certainly how things operate very much within business schools in the UK, and Carl and Mike would certainly recognise this picture. Okay. One of the interesting things, too, is about not only is these journal ranking lists and their imposition in conflict in some ways with addressing wider audiences and symbolic capital, but also working against teaching, and this came out from Wendy Brown's talk, I think, it was one of the points that you mentioned, that research and teaching to a certain extent in an important ways are pulling academics in different directions. But you think about it, almost every university, I'm sure the LSE does, I know Manchester does, talks about research-led teaching, but there's a conflict between them, and this was nicely reflected by this group called the Post-Crash Economics Society. I'm going to close just by talking about this a little bit. This was a group in Manchester of students who started saying, well, look, in our education, we're given all these sort of equilibrium models that are supposed to help us work for banks or some stuff. But what we'd rather actually have is a broader education that engages with contemporary challenges and draws on what's called more heterodox theory. So people like Marx, people like Minsky, who looked at private debt. And they wrote a report which you can access online called Economics Education and Learning, with a foreword by former member of the Bank of England, Andrew Haldane. And what's very interesting is this is an intelligent group of students at a number of universities are saying, well, actually, we want some pluralism, we want some Marx or some Minsky, but you wouldn't see any Marx or Minsky in a 3 or a 4 ranked economics journal, which is where all academics are now required to publish. And I want to close just by playing this clip, because it highlights this conflict or this tension between journal ranking culture and teaching, and it also reflects some of the ways in which the journal ranking systems are leading to the denigration of ideas. And this was an event in Manchester. It was sort of an academic discussion between a guy called Steve Keen, who's a heterodox economist. He's becoming head of department at Kingston in September. But he's drawn a lot on Minsky and alternative notions of private debt. And basically he was invited to have a discussion, an academic discussion, something we don't provide to students enough, really. An actual discussion between people with different perspectives. So he's having a discussion with a junior economics lecturer at Manchester called George Backus. So over 100 people there. And I'm going to play you the end of a question that's asked by a student who's a member of the Postgraduate Economics Society, and George Backus's response. But something at the end of this clip, I think, is very damaging and very revealing about what's actually happening to university. but I just played the clip.
We have a mission at the line. Put it in your model, and that will get you in the AER, and that's the American Economic Review, which is a four-ranked economics journal. So there, what you're really seeing is the denigration of ideas and wider social and intellectual capital through this system of academic capital that's created through the ABS list. I'll stop there.